Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. I've had a little bit of problem with Skype tonight. I hope everything is coming through clear. I don't have the usual screen that I normally get. I presume I'm coming through. So, anyhow, I believe it appears that the music has stopped, so I hope it has. Anyway, let me get my notes up. Tonight's topic is the paranormal. The setting is Russia. The paranormal does not mean occult or supernatural. It has nothing to do with religion of any kind. The definition of paranormal is that which demonstrably exists but lies outside the accepted normal of the society and culture that surrounds it. Therefore, it is to be investigated and not relegated to the realm of superstition. For the record, today is October 28th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 6 degrees, Scorpio. I have no website or blog. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com, and that's magus_18@geocities.com. If you want to subscribe, be on my e-list, just send me an email saying subscribe. Otherwise, just write me. I can't guarantee I can respond to all of my emails, but I will read all of them. I have the cat here on the back of my chair. Yep, she's still there. Got the dog out front. Hopefully he won't become any kind of a problem and I'll have to pause the show for any reason. So, anyway, I want to get further along to this book. And just FYI, I'm planning on doing another show tonight, same subject, more from this book. And then I'll do my Salon music, and then I'll probably take Salon off. And then I'll resume pretty much somewhat of a normal schedule after that, but I will get through this book. It's not a huge book, but nevertheless, I want to get through it. And so the shows will just be sporadic until done. And then I'll give everybody the title of the book and the author and where you can find it. And hopefully I'll be able to have the author on in an interview after that. So, anyway, go ahead and get started here. And the first one tonight is The Countess. The Countess rode home with Igor on his motorbike. She was a little puff of gray fur wrapped in an insulated handkerchief and nestled into the pocket of his field jacket. Only the tip of her little pink nose protruded from the closed pocket. Her eyes were still tightly shut. The veterinarian had expressed real doubts they would ever open. "She's just too young," he had said. Still, Olga wanted a kitten, and truth be known, Igor had already grown attached to the little cat resting in his pocket. They took turns sitting up with her, feeding her sugared milk with an eyedropper. She slept in a shoebox padded with one of Igor's woolen uniform shirts, a space just large enough to accommodate one minuscule cat in a hot water bottle wrapped in Igor's old fur shapka. The little cat, of course, thought the old cat was Mama. Somehow the kitten survived. The Countess, Igor called her, and the name stuck. "She doesn't know that she's a C-A-T. He would spell out the last word carefully in the event the Countess might hear and be offended. "She thinks she's a person, an aristocrat." In fact, the little cat was very bright. She learned from watching Igor and Olga. She was never exposed to cats. In fact, she intensely disliked cats. She had her own little bowl, her own little bed, and her very own little spot in front of the television. As she grew, she learned how to turn the television on and off by swatting repeatedly at the switch, which is only just within her reach, and how to change the channel by doing the same thing. One night, when the Countess was about a year old, Igor woke up suddenly in the night to the sound of the toilet flushing. Olga was asleep in bed beside him. Thieves, he thought, reaching into the nightstand for his service pistol. Stupid thieves on top of that. He tiptoed toward the bathroom, shoved the door open quickly, leveled his pistol, and switched on the light. The room was empty, no one around but the Countess, who looked up at him with big green eyes as though he were the village idiot. Must have been dreaming, he thought, and went back to bed. Later in the night, it happened again. This time, Igor knew he wasn't dreaming. He got up and crept to the bathroom and saw the Countess sitting on the toilet like a human, her tail raised, doing her duty. He watched in awe as she finished. Then, jumping almost straight up, she grabbed the pull chain of the overhead tank in her front paws, swung down with all of her weight on the chain, and flushed. Amazing, Igor thought, and laughed all the way back to bed. The next morning, he shared the story with Olga, who also thought it funny but completely understood. After all, I had to turn the page, the Countess had learned it from them. She had no idea she was a Kashka, a cat. Igor and Olga understood the Countess. They could communicate. It was as though she were the child they could never have. The Countess even learned to speak. She didn't meow like a normal cat. She broke her meows up into a rhythmic pattern. If you were around her long enough, you could almost make out his words in short sentences such as, "I love you, Papa. I'm hungry. And play with me." For more than 18 years, Igor, Olga, and the Countess lived together in harmony, a happy little family. The Countess was also childless, but she was always the baby, a perpetual child cosseted by her loving parents who adored her. No family photo was without the Countess. Her photos filled every album. She was Papa's baby. In the summer of 1997, just as the real warmth of summer was settling in on Moscow, the Countess died. She passed away in her sleep, a little old lady full on years. Igor and Olga were heartbroken, but they understood that she was rather old in cat years. They buried her in her favorite spot in the garden beneath the yellow rose and added a little brass plate that said, "The Countess, always Papa's baby, 6th of March, 1979, through the 23rd of July, 1997. The house was empty. It was devoid of laughter. Everywhere Igor and Olga looked, there was something that reminded them of the Countess. Her toys were exactly where she had left them. Her little bed still in its place in the corner, still containing the old Shapka, the one that had kept her warm in her first few weeks of life. Her pictures still grace the walls and the albums. Igor mentioned just once getting another kitten. Olga was horrified. No other cat could replace their baby. After a month after the Countess died, Igor woke suddenly in the night to the sound of the toilet flushing. He didn't give it a thought. It was just the Countess. Then he came completely awake. The Countess was gone. Silently, he reached into the nightstand and took out his old service automatic. He tiptoed to the bathroom, leveled the pistol, shoved the door open, and switched on the light. Nothing. Must have dreamed it, he thought, and went back to bed. Less than an hour later, it happened again. Once again, the toilet was empty. He padded off back to bed. As he lay there, thinking about what had happened, he felt something tug at the bedspread in a very familiar way. Distinctly heard a meow. Not just any meow, the Countess, as plain as day. Her rhythmic pattern, her feline attempt at human speech, was as plain as it had ever been as the little unseen cat bleated, "I love you, Papa." Igor smiled. "I love you too, Countess," he said softly, then rolled over and went to sleep. In the morning, he would tell Olga, who was still sleeping soundly. The next one was called A Shot in the Dark. For years, most of her adult life, in fact, Marina Ostenkova had suffered from the same recurrent nightmare. It wasn't a dream, actually. Or rather, it was not one she could remember. It was just a sound and a feeling. At least twice a week, usually several times, she would be awakened suddenly from a sound sleep by the sound of an explosion, a loud bang. It was a sharp, sudden, resounding crack. Not the low rumble of thunder, but more like the sound made when lightning strikes nearby or a large object falls from a distance. She would wake from sleep, her ears ringing, gripped with a sense of deep terror and a smothering, claustrophobic feeling as though a vice were being applied to her chest. It was as if there was no air for her to breathe. It was a hideous, terrifying experience. In its initial moments, It was accompanied by a feeling of abandonment and forlorn hope that was almost a physical presence. Fortunately, it passed quickly, although it could be counted on to happen only once in a given night. So, after a few minutes to compose herself, Marina could settle down and eventually get back to sleep. It wasn't easy at first, but she had years and years of practice. The strange and disquieting dream plagued her for more than 3/4 of a century. In all that time, no one had been able to tell her either what caused it or how to stop it. She had gone to doctor after doctor. She had even consulted a priest. Nothing helped. At least 2 times a week, usually more, she would wake in the darkness of her room, terror in her heart and ringing in her ears. No matter where she was, the dream came. It even followed her, finally, to the pensioner's home, in which she spent the final years of her life. The nurses and doctors, all of whom knew her, were aware of her problem. Like all the others before, they were powerless to help. Marina might not have known how to stop the dream, but she remembered with absolute certainty when it had begun. It had started in the winter of 1905, a few days after her fiancé died in the typhus epidemic that swept Russia in the aftermath of the war with Japan and the failed White Revolution. She had been only 17 years old at the time, just out of school, and looking forward to a bright future with her soon-to-be husband, an up-and-coming young cavalry officer in the Imperial Guards Regiment. Anatoly was of the select of the best and brightest. He was the only son and only surviving member of a tilted military family. The young couple had their entire lives in what looked at the time like a brilliant future ahead of them. Then all ended in ashes when the epidemic swept St. Petersburg. Typhus at that time was a 3-day killer. There was no cure, no reliable treatment. In 3 days, the patient either began to recover or they died. It was as simple as that. Such had been the case with Anatoly. He had died on the morning of the 3rd day. It had devastated Marina. She had not even had the chance to say goodbye. The disease was so dangerous, so contagious, Anatoly had died in isolation, and before the sun had set on the day of his death, he was buried. No priest, no wake, no proper mourning. It is traditional in Russia to have a 9-day period of mourning for the dead before burial, followed by a 40-day period of memorial observance before dedication of a monument for the deceased. With the victims of an epidemic, such things were simply impossible. Forget it, she was told by his commanding officer. There was no possible way a typhus victim was going to be put on public display. It would constitute a menace to the public safety. He was dead enough, all right. There was no need to keep him out of the ground for 9 days, just to make sure, to fulfill an empty tradition. With typhus, there was no possible doubt. They placed him in his family mausoleum beside his parents and next to a place that was, by consensus, reserved for Marina. That night, Marina Ostenkova cried herself to sleep. 3 days later, the nightmares began. They never left her. Marina never married. She eventually returned to school, extended her education, and devoted a long lifetime to teaching the dubious joys of Russian literature to unwilling and uninterested scholars. When asked, she always held that she was a widow, and she mourned her Anatoly until the day she joined him in the great mausoleum in St. Petersburg. Let me clear my throat. The one that held each generation of his family almost back to the beginning, the one that had not been opened in 76 years, until the small party of mourners accompanied Marina on her final journey. It was a beautiful day, as only springtime in St. Petersburg can be. The cemetery, one of the oldest in the city, is in a quiet section of town near Hermitage, the winter palace of the Tsars. It is the resting place of poets, artists, and aristocrats. It is a very prestigious place to spend eternity, and a beautiful one, in a staid and somber sort of way. The caretaker of the cemetery took a key from his belt, removed a large rusting padlock from the outer gate of the crypt, then carefully chipped away the seal on the door of the marble vault. Slowly, the light of day crept into the musty, dusty room. As it did, it revealed a sight that chilled the dozen or so mourners who bore Marina to her final resting place. Amid the rows of coffins, one stood open. Beside it, on the floor, sat a skeleton dressed in the rotting remnants of the uniform of a lieutenant of the Imperial Guards. The cracked, dry, rotted cover of his holster stood open, and a quaint old Nagant revolver lay loosely in the bony grip of his right hand. For a long moment, they stood aghast. All of them knew about Marina's nightmare. They all knew of the lifelong experience of the single gunshot in the night that had plagued her sleep for generations. And okay, the next one is called Lady with the Lantern. It was the winter of 1919, and the four horsemen of the apocalypse rode roughshod over the frozen yet smoking remains of the fallen Tsar's vast empire. Vladimir Lenin's fledging socialist government, recently moved to Moscow from St. Petersburg, was locked in the grip of a life-and-death struggle with the remnants of the monarchist in the form of the White Russian Army and their foreign allies. Civil war racked the land. Along with the war came starvation and pestilence on a scale that was unheard of. Not since the ravages of the Black Death 400 years before had things been so grim in Russia. On top of all of this, it was a particularly bad winter. Now, in Russia, bad does not mean cold. The winter was not particularly cold by Russian standards, and therefore lay the problem. The temperature rose and fell like a roller coaster that year, relatively warm one day and bitterly cold the next. It was what the old people call flu weather, and the flu, the vast worldwide epidemic of Spanish influenza, descended on Russia with a force that was beyond human comprehension. The combination of revolution, civil war, the repressions of the Cheka, mass executions, and the starvation brought on by Lenin's agrarian reform combined to make life for most Russians worse than a living hell. It was as though Almighty God was raining his vengeance on a country already gone mad. They called it the three-day plague. If the person afflicted did not show signs of improvement within 3 days of onset, if the fever that often reached 5 degrees did not break and the accompanying convulsions cease, it was a certainty the patient would die before the fourth sunrise. More than 2 million Russians entered eternity in this manner. Novgorod, one of the oldest cities in Russia, located approximately 100 miles north of Moscow, was hit hard. Within the space of a week, half of the city's population of 15,000 was either dead or dying. So many were sick there were none fit to bury the dead. Doctors, already in short supply, fell like trees under the blows of a woodsman's axe. Nurses were non-existent, and the nuns from the convent on the outskirts of the city, who usually performed such duties, were too busy taking care of their own to worry about others. Sisters of charity they might well be, but charity began, at least in this time of trial, at home. Even if all this had not been the case, in that winter of 1919, there was precious little anyone could do. The doctors were helpless. This is a time before the advent of antibiotics, before over-the-counter remedies could control common flu symptoms, and 3 generations before vaccination would almost eliminate the threat forever. The most that could be done was to sit with the sick, to see that they took in fluids and stayed bundled against the chill, and hope or pray the fever would break. Into this winter of suffering, a single woman walked unafraid. Countess Ekaterina Ordovsky, the Lady with the Lantern. Contrary to popular myth in the West, and certainly contrary to the current nostalgia craze sweeping certain aspects of Russian society, the Russian aristocracy was not particularly well-loved at the time of the October Revolution, at least not among the common people. If they had been, there wouldn't have been a revolution, would there? However, to every rule there is an exception, and Countess Ordovsky was that exception. Alone and unafraid, this gallant woman took control of the night, the worst time for those suffering from the deadly epidemic. Indifferent to her own health and well-being, she went from house to house, sometimes wading through snowdrifts up to her waist to bring comfort, if not aid, to the suffering. No one was too high in society to warrant her care, no one too low. She visited them, trudging through the snow, a lantern in her hand, and a milk can filled with hot cabbage soup, the best she could offer, strapped to her frail back. For 3 long weeks, the epidemic raged in Novgorod. Finally, as suddenly as it came, it began to abate, but only after a frightful toll. More than half the population was dead. As life returned to normal, some of those who recovered remembered the Countess, the aristocrat, the lady with the lantern. No one had seen her once the sickness passed, but that was not unusual. She pretty much kept to herself. Although she was well thought of by the community, her late husband had been one of the causes of the revolution, at least in the Novgorod region. No one had mourned when he was arrested and summarily shot as an enemy of the people in the Soviet state. Not even the Countess. Some had noticed. A delegation from the city Soviet was dispatched to the apartment she inhabited in the vast, sprawling mansion that had once been her home. Repeated knocks on the door brought no response. Finally, the Russian respect for privacy gave way to concern, and the door was forced open. There, before the startled eyes of the committee, lying on her bed as if asleep, was the dead body of the Countess Ordovsky. She was fully dressed, and on the floor beside her bed sat a battered old milk can with a length of rope through the handles, forming a makeshift shoulder strap. She was stiff, and the body had begun to discolor with decomposition in spite of the sub-freezing temperature in the room. It was obvious from the condition of the body that she had been dead for at least a month. And the next one is called Name Change. It is almost a cliche to say that Elena Sajana is one of those women who must have been designed with some Western caricaturist in mind. She is the living, breathing image of the typical Russian babushka, or grandmother. She is a short, plump little woman in her mid-70s with a pleasing smile and what people everywhere call laughing eyes. She's retired now, but for years she worked in the Mamontovka tractor factory, hauling heavy crates from the warehouse to the assembly line on a little wheeled cart. Elena has the lungs and vocabulary of a dock worker and the physical build of a linebacker for Green Bay. Mamontovka is not large. It takes about 15 minutes to walk from one side of the town to the other. Elena did exactly this every night around midnight for more than 25 years. In all that time, she was never bothered on her nightly walk home. Even if Mamontovka was not the peaceful, sedate little place that it is, Elena had no cause for fear. The woman, quite honestly, could go bear hunting with a switch. One night, shortly before she retired from the factory, an event occurred that changed her life completely. It was a cold and rainy night in mid-September. The weather had turned unusually early that year. So when she got off work, Elena decided to take a shortcut home. It was late, but the idea of cutting through the local cemetery did not bother her at all, especially since the shortcut would get her home twice as soon as would otherwise have been possible. Elena Sajana grew up in Mamontovka and knew all the stories that were and are told about the local graveyard. She was, however, a skeptic. She didn't believe in ghosts, and brushed aside all the stories as being the result of too much vodka and too much free time. When the whistle blew at the factory, she put on her coat, pulled off her fur collar, snugged her fur cap down onto her graying hair, and started for home. The rain had stopped falling, but a thin mist remained in the chill air, and the pathway was little more than a river of mud. Still, she made good progress, past the silent shops, past the deserted church, and through the wrought iron fence into the Montovka Cemetery. She whistled as she walked. Her mood was, as usual, a good one. The only thing on her mind was getting home and sharing a cup of tea with her husband, Ivan, a retired Army major. As she made her way deeper and deeper into the cemetery, she began to hear a faint tapping sound. At first, she couldn't quite make out where it was coming from. It seemed to be everywhere at once. She ignored it and kept walking. As she pushed farther along, however, the sound grew louder until it finally became quite annoying. What idiot would be working in the cemetery this late at night, she wondered. The noise became still louder as she walked. Some teenager trying to have a joke, she muttered, trying to scare people passing by. By now, she could tell which direction the noise was coming from and decided to have a look. Elena turned off the main path onto one of the side tracks that led among the tightly packed graves. After about 20 yards, she came to the source of the sound. A tall, gaunt man knelt in front of one of the stones, chipping away at the inscription. "What do you think you're doing, comrade?" she demanded, with all of the authority her voice could muster. "Defacing graves is not only disrespectful of the dead, it is a crime." Before she could continue, the man stood and faced her. His face was a mask of embarrassment and dismay. His arms hung limply at his side as he spoke, his eyes deep and dark, pleading. "I am not defacing it, comrade. The fools misspelled my name." With that, the man vanished. Elena Sajana hurried back to the main path, and within 5 minutes, she was home. Whether she imagined it or not, whether it was a figment of her imagination on that rainy, damp, dark evening or not, Elena will tell everyone who asked that she will never go into the graveyard after dark again. She hasn't in more than 10 years. Okay, I'm going to stop for just a second, play a song, and I'll be right back. Okay. This next one is called Hitchhiker. Lieutenant Colonel Dmitry Pleskov had almost 20 years in the service. For a bit more than 10, ever since he came home from Afghanistan, he had been commanding officer of the Soviet, later Russian, Air Force, 10th Maintenance Wing, based in Balaz, B-O-L-O-Z-H, a small town about 15 miles east of Kazan. Like most professional officers, she lived in town and commuted back and forth. He lived in town and commuted back and forth to the base. Halfway between Balaz and the base is the Balaz Balata, or Balaz Swamp, an infamous stretch of semi-marshland stretching along a curve in the Volga River just before its juncture with the Kazanka. Until fairly recently, this area was a true swamp. Several hundred acres of mud, reeds, and twisted underbrush traveled only by the brave. Now, however, things are changing. Much of the Balata has been drained and is considered some of the most fertile farmland in the area, producing fine crops of sugar beets and potatoes. This land is flat and empty in all directions and has sections of hedgerows and birch forests to break the ever-present wind that sweeps down from the steppes. Because it is near the river, it is always covered with a heavy fog in the evenings and early morning. It is a remote and isolated stretch of highway, not for a good place for a car to break down, and Dmitry was always glad to be past it. Because the place was so desolate, Dima, like most other motorists in Russia, was prone to pick up anyone he saw walking along the road. In the West, this is rare, but in Russia, it is common and safe. It is understood in the Balaz that hitchhiking is the way many people make their way to work or into the town to do their shopping and home in the evening. Dima knew almost all of the farmers and factory workers who lived in that area and had, at one time or another, given most of them rides. It was the fall of 1995, and Dima's squadron had been on a stand-to for more than a week. It was a routine exercise, but when the time came to go home, he was ready. It was past 2 o'clock in the morning when he reached the Balaz Balata. Intermittent patches of fog hung heavy on the night air. The visibility would drop suddenly to practically zero. Then things would improve, and the headlights of his aging Volga sedan would cast a dim, flickering yellow glow on the road ahead for 300 or 400 yards at a time. Then there were times when the fog would break, and there would be maybe 100 yards of fairly good visibility before entering the next cloud. Typical weather for this place at this time. To make matters worse, the highway had been built during the Second World War as a way of reaching the airfield from the nearby city. Never in the best of repair, it was a typical old-style road, constructed of cement rather than asphalt and filled with potholes. This was nighttime driving, Russian style, at its deadly worst. Dima had just come out of one of the low-lying cloud banks when he noticed a man standing beside the road. The man was dressed in a set of blue-green coveralls and looked as if he were wearing a welder's helmet. He carried a canvas-colored rucksack or backpack of some sort tucked tightly under his left arm. As Dima drove slowly past, the man gave no indication. He had even seen the blue Volga sedan. That's strange, Pleskov thought. This late at night, you would think he'd try and flag a ride. He drove on another 100 yards or so, then decided to back up and offer the man a lift. It was, after all, a miserable night. As Dima backed up through the right window, as he reached over to unlock the passenger door, he saw the man start toward the car. As he approached, the car began to cough and run rough, and the already dim headlights grew so faint the road in front of the car went completely dark. Dima glanced quickly at the dashboard, looking for an oil light or some other warning. Then as suddenly as they had gone out, the lights came back on and the car began running smoothly again. When Dima looked back out the rear window to see what the hitchhiker was doing, the man was gone. Thinking the hitchhiker might have been a little drunk and fallen in the ditch, Pleshkov stopped his car, took a flashlight out of his map case, and got out to have a look. He searched for about 5 minutes and found absolutely nothing. Not a trace of the man was to be seen. A cold chill shot through him, and the hair on the back of his neck began to stand on end. He returned to his car, shaking, and did not stop again until he got to his flat in a double shot of vodka. Several days passed, and Dima more or less forgot about the incident. He certainly didn't mention it to anyone. Then about 2 weeks later, he was headed home, once again crossing the Balata, when he happened on a militia roadblock not too far from where he had seen the strange hitchhiker. In the middle of the Balata, this was somewhat strange. So once he had stopped, he got out of his car and asked the police sergeant in charge what was going on. The militiaman told him a farmer who had been clearing part of the Balata for farmland had found the remains of an old Second World War bomber with the crew still inside. Being he was an Air Force officer, this intrigued Dima, and he wandered over to have a look. Sure enough, halfway dug out of the marshy ground was what appeared to be a twin-engine Tu-2 medium bomber. It was in reasonably good condition, considering it had been in the mire for at least half a century, and there inside, still strapped into their seats, was the crew, or rather what was left of them, all wearing the remains of the standard gray-green flight suit and the metal-reinforced leather flying helmets that had been used at the time by the Red Air Force. About 50 feet from the main body of the wreckage, another body was found, dressed like the others. This one had a rotting canvas dispatch case under his left arm. He had been headed in the direction of the highway. And let me clear my throat real quick. And let me light a smoke real quick here. The next one is called Emergency Stop. The Siberiac was late in trying to make up time. I guess that is someone from Siberia. They call him a Siberiac. The spring of 1998 had been a wet one, and in many places the train had been slowed to a near crawl by water on the tracks. The Siberiac didn't have another scheduled stop for another 100 kilometers, so the engineer was pushing the big electric engine and her 21 cars to the maximum possible speed, given the conditions, about 100 kilometers per hour. It was snowing, nothing new in western Siberia in March, but not enough to present a problem. Just behind the engine in the first wagon, Nina Konstantinovna, the train's chief stewardess, relaxed in her tiny stateroom over a cup of tea. It was almost midnight, and she would start her final inspection round of the day, seeing that the car was in good order before dimming the lights in the corridor. She looked out her window at the passing countryside as she contemplated what had been, up until this point, a rather uneventful day. Outside, the outskirts of the village of Gromyko came into view. No stop here. The place was so small, it only had scheduled stops by the regional local train. Mainline passenger service and mail pickups were all handled through Barabinsk, which was still more than an hour away. Suddenly, the red warning light in her cabin began to flash, just as the train started to shudder and sway violently. The air brakes on the engine screamed as the gentle whirring sound and vibration of the big engine's electric motor died to a whisper, covered completely by the scream of the brakes being applied for a full emergency stop. Sparks showered from the rails as the cars clanged together like 21 thunderclaps in the dark, still Siberian night, in the dark, still Siberian night. Nina jumped out, steadied herself, and headed for the engine to find out what was wrong. Regardless of what it was, she and the stewards and stewardesses under her supervision will now have their work cut out for them. As she started out of her compartment, she glanced down the hall behind her. No smoke. There wasn't a fire, at least not in his car. No unusual smell of any kind. In wagon number one, everything looked more or less normal. All along the 80-foot length of the car, people were emerging from their compartments. Many were half awake and looked toward the steel-sealed outer doors at each end of the wagon. Others huddled into small groups talking. One man shouted as he worked his way toward the end of the car. Nina stepped quickly through the companionway and into the engine. Chief Engineer Anatoly Podkrishkin and his two assistants were shaking and white with fear. "We hit her," Podkrishkin said in a quivering voice. "It couldn't be helped. We hit her." "Who?" Nina Konstantinovna asked. "This certainly didn't look good." "The woman, Podkrishkin. She jumped out on the tracks and started waving her arms, trying to get us to stop. She was too close." His voice faded. Just as he finished speaking, Sergeant Oleg Kashin, head of the Sibiriak's police squad, came through the door. "What's wrong?" he asked in a solemn voice that belied his 24 years. "What happened?" "You'll have to go out and investigate," Podrishkin said glumly. "We hit a woman who ran out onto the tracks." "Oh, my God." Kashin pushed the bottom of the intercom attached to the wall of the cab and summoned his partner, Ivan Kolchak, from the nearmost wagon on the train. The two policemen donned their coats and hats and swung down onto the right-of-way. They then separated and began walking the track on either side of the roadbed. From the cab, Nina Konstantinovna and the three men of the engine crew watched their flashlights dance in the night as the two men searched. Less than 10 minutes later, Kashin and Kolchak were back. The short, blonde sergeant had a bundle in his arms. "We didn't find a woman, but we found this." He held out the bundle and revealed an infant, maybe a year old, wrapped in a white blanket. She was lying on the tracks, about 200 meters up the track. In half an hour's time, the Sibiriak was once again plunging into the night, headed for Novosibirsk. In Barabinsk, a report was made concerning the incident, and the child was turned over to the local authorities. Let me clear my throat. About a month later, Nina Konstantinovna, who was on her break, crews on the long-haul trains customarily work 1 month on and 1 month off, received a telephone call. It was Oleg Kashin. "Nina Konstantinovna," he began, "you are not going to believe this." "What is it?" "Well, you remember that incident on the Moscow run last month? We have some information on it now." "So tell me," she said. "Don't keep me in suspense." "It's this way," the young man continued. "Barabinsk militia turned the child over to a children's home. It seems that the parents are dead." "Dead?" In the course of the next 3 or 4 minutes, Oleg Kashin told one of his strangest stories Nina Konstantinovna had ever heard. The child's natural mother had died giving birth. The father, faced with the prospect of raising a small child alone, had remarried almost at once to a woman much younger than himself. His new wife soon became quite upset over the amount of attention her husband was paying to the child and apparently lost her mind. She decided, in her husband's absence, to do the baby in. While the child slept, she took it and laid it on the railroad tracks. Then she packed her things and left. She was later arrested in Barabinsk. When the husband claimed his child from the militia, he was questioned as to whom the woman could possibly be who had stopped the train, then vanished into the night. To everyone's amazement, the description of the woman matched exactly that of the man's first wife, the baby's mother, who had been dead for just over a year. And next one is called the doctor's buggy. actors Viktor Ivanov and Leonid Karanovsky were fighting a losing battle and knew it. 1905 had been a bad year for Russia. War, revolution, famine, and plague all had come within the span of a single year. In the wake of the Tsar's disastrous war with Japan, followed by the equally ill-fated uprising against him and his hated Okhrana, the political police, the twin scourges of cholera and typhus swept Russia from the Baltic to the Pacific. It was as if God in heaven were punishing the already long-suffering peoples of the East. Russia, as always, was short of doctors, clinics, and hospitals. Even if there had been enough, the average Russian, whether living in his or her tiny village or in one of the great cities, was superstitious and ignorant. Every house and hovel had a trove of home remedies and plethora of tales concerning how to use them. They might call a priest, but they would seldom call a doctor unless things were absolutely beyond all hope. Of course, in 1905, there was a little doctor who could do in any case. What medicines existed for cholera were primitive and ineffective unless administered extremely early in the course of the disease. Wait a minute. Did I read this? No, I don't think so. I don't think I read this. Okay. This has just got some similarities to that other story. With typhus, you either recovered or you didn't. It was that simple. Because of this, most Russians only called a doctor as last resort, and the approach of the doctor's buggy generally prompted a flurry of peasants crossing themselves and saying hasty prayers for the dead. It never occurred to them the doctors were trying as hard as they knew how to save lives. They never considered that often the doctors rode all through the night, through any kind of weather and across any obstacle, to answer the summons of some farmer who could not pay them and did not really believe they could help. The doctors knew that, for the most part, they were viewed as harbingers of death. Consequently, most of the time, Ivanov and Karanovsky were someone too late to do any real good. In most cases, they arrived in time to certify the death, or at best, to preside over it. Rarely did they make any real difference in the course of the disease. Still, they tried, and in rare instances, they made some headway. Occasionally, they arrived in time. Sometimes, their patient survived. That made it worth the effort. Just before midnight, on December 22nd, 1905, a knock came at the door of the two-story brownstone house the two doctors and their family shared at Tunganska Street in Moscow. Ivanov opened the door to find a girl of about 16, bundled against the driving wind and snow in a ragged, oversized robe, standing patiently, waiting for someone to answer. "What is it, child?" she asked as he looked her over. She was an attractive girl, with straw-colored hair hanging limply from beneath a cloth worker's cap and piercing blue eyes. She appeared to be slightly dirty and seemed to have some old bruises on her thin face. Not unusual, he thought. Typical, in fact. "Are you the comrade, doctor?" she responded. "I'm one of them," Ivanov smiled slightly. The girl had obviously been sent to him because her people knew he and Karanovsky were Bolsheviki communists. Most likely they didn't trust any other physicians. He grimaced, remembering his own treatment at the hands of the Okhrana not too very far in the past. "What can I do for you?" "You have to come quickly. It's my mother. We think it's cholera." "Just a moment," the tall, thin man with the neatly trimmed beard and little round glasses replied. "I must tell my partner that I'm going out on a call." He hastened upstairs and knocked on the door to the room of Karanovsky and his wife shared next door to his own. Karanovsky's wife was in labor, her first child. It wouldn't be right to call him out on this of all nights. In less than a minute, Viktor Ivanov was back in the downstairs hallway. He moved quickly but precisely. He did not say another word except to tell the girl to calm herself and try and relax. I'll do what I can, he told her. He grabbed his coat, shapka, and bag and headed for the door, motioning for the girl to follow. He went directly to the tiny shed behind the house and hitched his horse to the buggy as the girl sat on the seat and held his bag. As he worked, he queried the girl on the location of the call. Satisfied he knew how to get there, he set off. Half an hour later, the doctor's buggy pulled up in front of a small two-room house on the northern outskirts of the city. As usual, shutters were cracked as he pulled up against the curb, and faces peered from the windows of neighboring houses. He tied his horse to a lamppost and followed the girl inside. The girl led him to a small room off the main one and ushered him inside. There, lying in a rusting iron bed wrapped in half a dozen layers of blankets, lay a woman of about 30. She was obviously in the early stages of the disease, the stage of fever and chills. The girl nodded silently to the doctor and departed. Ivanov went to work. It was touch and go until morning, but with the dawn came improvement. It looked for a change as though the woman was going to pull through. By noon, she was able to sit up and take thin soup from a spoon, and Ivanov knew that he had, for once, arrived in time. About 3 p.m, the woman's husband came home and found his wife much recovered and the doctor preparing to leave. "You are lucky," Ivanov told the man. "If your daughter had not come when she did, your wife would be dead by now. It was very close." "My daughter?" the man asked, with a puzzled look on his face. "Well, I assume she was, the girl your wife sent." He described the child, come to think of it, he had not seen since arriving. "Comrade doctor, the girl that you are describing is indeed my daughter, but I do not see how she could have possibly led you here. Is that the girl you saw?" He pointed to a worn photograph sitting on a nightstand near his wife's bed. Ivanov looked the photograph over. "Yes, that's her," he said, "a charming child." "And a dead one," the man said flatly as he crossed himself. "She died in October. Our little father, the Tsar's Okhrana, thought she was a courier for the party. She lived about a week after her release from being questioned in the Tanganyika prison." Once again, the neighbors stared at his passing buggy as Ivanov drove past their houses. He ignored them, lulled even deeper into thought by the steady clop, clop, clop of his horse's hooves on the cobblestones. "If they only knew," he thought, "they think that I bring death. What would they think if they knew that for once death had brought me?" He drove home in silence. Later that day, after he had given himself time to think it over, he told the story to his partner, Dr. Karanovsky, and Karanovsky's wife, Theodora, who had just given birth to a baby boy. It was Dr. Leonid Karanovsky who eventually told the story to me. Dr. Karanovsky was my granddaughter. And let me clear my throat real quick. Okay. Let me go back up to a different section of the book here. And I'm going to light another cigarette. We'll read one more story here before I play another song. This one is called In a Class by Herself. School 86 is one of the oldest public schools in Russia, a part of Lenin's original five. I think I read this. Yeah, I believe I did. Let's see here. Yeah, I did. Okay, glad I caught that early on. I was kind of jumping around the first week or so when I was reading these, and then I decided, well, I better start at some point and then just get to a certain point and then jump back. Let's see here. Let me make sure that I had not read this one. No, I haven't. Okay, this one is called The Taste Test. If I go back and check that I did not read that one and it just sounded a little familiar, I will. I'll read it again. I'll read it on the next show. I know I didn't read this one. It says, to quote the famous, some might say infamous, Friar Tuck, let us now speak of God's greatest gift to man, beer. Klaus Hauser and Otto Ohlendorf came to Russia in the usual way for Germans of their age group. They rode into the country on the back of a Tiger tank in June of 1941. 3 long, blood-sucked, frozen years later, they walked all the way from Leningrad, now again called St. Petersburg, to a prisoner of war camp in the little town of Yaroslavl, with their hands over their heads and a horde of angry Russians watching them. There they remained until the spring of 1946, a full year after the war had ended. It was not the way most immigrants began their sojourn in a new land, not exactly what one would call an auspicious beginning for a new life. Klaus and Otto spent much of their time working on public projects, roads, bridges, levees, snow slides, and the rest of it, talking and dreaming about getting back to their native Hamburg and the thing that was dearest to their hearts, beer. Before the war, both men had had the good fortune to work for a good noted brewery in Hamburg. Otto had been a brewmaster while Klaus was a senior mechanic, responsible for the maintenance of the delicate equipment needed to make good beer. For years, the citizens of Yaroslavl had belabored the city central committee with a single request. They wanted a brewery. Of course, the city fathers were in total agreement, but there were other things that took precedence, such as schools, clinics, and kindergartens. Then the war came along. There was also the sad fact that no one in Yaroslavl had the first idea of how to build or to run a brewery, and Moscow was not about to send them experts, not at a time like this. Finally, someone had an idea. Germany was famous for its brew. Why not go out to the POW camp and see if any of the visiting Huns had any idea how to go about it? The Central Committee seemed to think that was a good idea, so they beat a path to the POW camp in search of the expertise they were sadly lacking. It was there they found Klaus and Otto. Not only did the two men know how to make beer, they were intimately familiar with the construction of breweries. After a few minutes of negotiations, the two men left the camp in the company of several guards, headed for an abandoned factory building on the outskirts of town. The plan was to convert it into a brewery, if possible. They didn't know it at the time, but Klaus and Otto were leaving the camp for good. It was one of the ironies of life that these men, who had, as prisoners, dreamed for years about returning home, never made it, except as visitors to their native land many years later. Klaus and Otto never returned to the camp, and they never returned to Hamburg. When the last of the prisoners were repatriated, both men elected to remain in Russia. Germany was a ruin, and after all, they had begun to adapt. They both dutifully joined the party. Soon they both married local girls and began to raise families and brew beer. At first, they were those damned fascists, then those damned Germans. With time, they became simply those Germans, and by the time the brewery was privatized in the fall of 1992 to the citizens of Yaroslavl, our Germans. The change was gradual, but it was irreversible. Between 1946 and the present time, Yarpivo is the Russian word for beer, became a name to conjure within European Russia. From their humble beginnings in the bombed-out old factory building on the outskirts of Yaroslavl, Klaus and Otto presided over the birth of a dynasty. With a formula borrowed from their pre-war employer, they brewed, quite honestly, one of the best beers in Europe. The two men worked as a team to make sure the quality was always at the highest possible level. Each morning, Otto would arrive in his office to find a bottle of the last day's release in a mug sitting on his desk, along with a bowl of salted pretzels. Klaus made sure it was right. It was Klaus made sure it was there, right on time, every day. Otto was more than a brewmaster. He was a connoisseur. Many mornings, the hallway would literally vibrate with the sound of his gruff voice as he bellowed out through his open door. "Damn it, Klaus, this," expletive deleted, "is undrinkable. Dump the batch and wait for the next brewing. We can't sell this," expletive deleted. By the way, I'm not saying that. The book says expletive deleted. "They'd be coming after us with pitchforks and torches. We have reputations to serve." Across the hall, an answering bellow would erupt. "I know it's undrinkable. That's why I left it there for you. You're the brewmaster. Go figure out what's wrong. It tastes like kerosene." "Why don't you stop bellowing like a moose in heat? If it tastes like kerosene," Otto would growl like an injured bear, "it's because your mechanics are careless with the cleaning." On it went, without fail, every morning for 45 years. Then it ended. Otto suffered a massive heart attack in the winter of 1993 and did not recover. His passing was a blow not only to the brewery, but to the entire city of Yaroslavl, which had taken the two transplanted Germans as their own. Otto Ohlendorf's funeral was one of the largest the city had ever seen. Even the schools closed in his honor. Otto's son soon followed in his father's footsteps as brewmaster, but even he would admit he simply can't fill his father's shoes. Otto's old office across the hallway from Klaus's is still just the way he left it, neat, clean, and precise in every way, and unoccupied. And an hour later, when they all gather, Klaus, Otto's son Rolf, and any other two people they can grab for witnesses to remove the offering, if the bottle is still full, they dump the batch, wait a few days, and release the next brewing. After all, they can't sell a product that tastes like kerosene. Their customers would be after them with pitchforks and torches. They have their reputations to think of. And so let me play another song here. And I'll be right back. Okay, I was looking that that story over that I thought that I might have read before, and I haven't, so I'm going to go ahead and read it. It's called In a Class by Herself. School 86 is one of the oldest public schools in Russia, a part of Lenin's original five-year plan to modernize Russia in the aftermath of the years of revolution, counter-revolution, and civil war. It stands on a hill overlooking the conjunction of Kazanka and the great Volga rivers in the city of Kazan, the capital of the Autonomous Republic of Tatarstan. Before Lenin, there were no public schools in Russia. All schools were private and very expensive. Aside from free education for the masses, Lenin introduced yet another innovation. All schools, founded after the revolution in 1917, were coeducational. Both boys and girls were allowed, encouraged, in fact, to get an education. Nadia Kozlova is literally in a class by herself. Undoubtedly, she is the brightest student ever to attend School 86. A senior in her 11th year of public school, her overall grade point average is 4.9957, one of the highest in all of Russia. In her entire scholastic career, Nadia Kozlova has never missed a single day of classes, not one. She could easily claim the gold medal for first place in academics. Every teacher who has ever seen her work would recommend her. And literally dozens of teachers have seen it. There's just one problem. No one at School 86 has ever seen Nadia. Each day her work is turned in. Each day it is in the same neat, precise, long hand that is one of the trademarks of this intelligent girl. No one knows quite how it is turned in. No one sees her or anyone else place the old-fashioned brown manila folder on the teacher's desk at the end of each school day. In fact, no one in living memory has ever seen Nadia at all. Nadia Kozlova is a ghost. In 1926, less than 4 years after School 86 opened its doors, they were closed again quite suddenly. At least they would have been closed if there had been any doors left. Early one morning, in late February, an explosion ripped through the building. Coal dust in the bunker underneath the school, which was filled only to half capacity, ignited, most likely from a spark given off by the nearby furnace. The resulting blast demolished the entire building at exactly 7:43 a.m., according to the wall clock that was later found in the charred rubble. School 86 ceased to exist. Only a large black smoking crater remained. I'm going to clear my throat real quick. The school day in Russia does not begin until 9 a.m. I didn't get it clear. Hold on. Okay, hopefully it's clear now. The school day in Russia does not begin until 9 a.m. Fortunately, there were few people in the building at the time of the explosion. The school's director, three teachers, the librarian, the janitor, and Nadia Kozlova, all of them disappeared without a trace. Nadia, who was at the time in her final year of school and vying for the gold medal for excellence, had come to school early that day to do a little extra work in the library. She wanted desperately to go on to university, and for a girl from a poor family, the stipend that went along with the gold medal was the only way in which that would be possible. Even though all education was, and still is, free, as long as the student can pass the examinations, her room and board represented a fantastic sum for her family. Nadia had a dream. Nadia's dream cost her her life. Ever since that time, every graduating class at School 86 has an extra unofficial member, Nadia Kozlova. No one has ever seen her. No photograph of her exists. Only her name on a tiny brass plate affixed to the front hallway of the school. Yet she is there. She has never missed a day. There is a small wooden cabinet in the office of the director. That cabinet contains 78 years worth of Nadia's completed work. It is there for all to see, and every single piece is almost letter perfect. You see, Nadia's amazing GPA doesn't simply span 4 years. It spans more than three quarters of a century. And This next one is called The Face in the Window. Tatiana Andreyevna is a beautiful woman. She does not have the face that launched 1,000 ships. In fact, it is safe to say that on the traditional 1 to 10 scale that is crassly used worldwide to rate beauty in women and good looks in men, she would rate about a 1. Getting a 0 rating is impossible. Tatiana's looks are legendary and Mamontovka. As a child, she was burned horribly with a kerosene heater in her parents' when a kerosene heater in her parents' flat exploded and showered her with the burning fuel. Ever after, she was undeniably the most recognizable person in the village. Her scars didn't matter. Her late husband would simply smile when someone mentioned them. Then he would state a simple truth. Tatiana is beautiful. Physical beauty is not everything. It is not Tatiana's face that makes her beautiful. It is her soul. You see, everyone in Mamontovka loves Tatiana Andreyevna. She has a beautiful spirit. For years, she was the community welcome wagon. She took it upon herself to greet every new person and family moving into the Mamontovka area, armed with the traditional Russian offering of bread and salt and the warm smile of an angel. In rain, snow, or summer heat, Tatiana was always there. 4 generations of children played under her watchful eye as their parents went about their daily task. Since she did not work, it was the least that she could do. In times of sickness and times of mourning, Tatiana was there, always with a word of comfort and some small offering. Home-baked bread, a bottle of homemade wine, cakes. She was there, Tatiana, with the beautiful soul. In time, age and arthritis and the fragile bones that came with 80-odd years took their toll, and Tatiana Andreyevna could no longer carry out her self-appointed duties. Still, even now, when weather permits, she sits in her wheelchair on the balcony of her little third-floor flat on Kuznetsky Most Avenue and watches the people pass, waving to each and smiling brightly. When the weather is foul, as it often is in Russia in the fall and winter, she sits by her kitchen window and watches the street below. Everyone knows her. Everyone waves and smiles when they see her face in the window. But no one ever goes to her flat. No one ever visits Tatiana. For her, there are no gifts of bread and salt, no cakes and wine. For her, there is only the balcony, the window, and the smiling faces below. She doesn't seem to mind. The smiles of passerby seem to be enough for her. Now, after all the years that Tatiana Andreyevna spent making people welcome, after all the sleepless nights she spent sitting with the sick and watching over the bodies of the departed, you would think people would be kinder. She would not be a beauty, but she might not be a beauty, but she does, in fact, have a beautiful soul. The thing is, the little flat is locked. If you look closely, when the light is just right, you will see that the wheelchair on the balcony is a rusting relic. Tatiana died almost 10 years ago. The entire community mourned the passing of their welcome wagon. It was one of the largest funerals in the history of the village. Everyone turned out. They even let out school in her honor. It is Tatiana Andreyevna's beautiful soul, her spirit that greets people from the window with a warm smile of an angel. And this next one is called "And Then There Were None," and that is, the word none is spelled N-U-N, and then there were none. The covenant of Our Lady of Sorrows is out in the middle of nowhere. It is so far out in the sticks, you have to chase the owl off your clock in the morning before you can tell what time it is. It is so far out in the boondocks, the emaciated wolves really do chase the starving bears through the frozen, deserted forest. Well, it's not really that bad, but it's rather isolated. The convent is something like 40 miles from Novosibirsk as the crow flies. As the narrow one-lane dirt track that leads to its winds, it's more like 60. And the convent is located a good healthy 2-mile walk from the meandering little road. So the occasional visitor is compelled to exert himself or herself and put forth a genuine effort if they really want to see the convent of Our Lady of Sorrows. Of course, it was intended to be that way. The nuns who founded the convent back in the early days of the last century were looking for the isolation the remote reaches of Western Siberia provide. They were a contemplative order dedicated to prayer, fasting, and meditation. They were called to be apart from the world. Every morning, the air rings with the chanting of the morning office. All through the day, the somber, black-clad figures of the sisters can be seen as they go about their daily chores, much as they did a century ago. Modern conveniences are unknown to the convent of Our Lady of Sorrows. Everything is done by hand. Even in the dead of winter, the nuns can be seen hauling water from the little river that runs nearby. Indoor plumbing is not known in the confines of the convent. In the winter, when the sun rises late and sets early, when there are only 4 hours of pale daylight to be had, the glimmering light of candles illuminates the sisters' prayers to be extinguished altogether at the conclusion of the evening office. The sisters never travel into the city. The convent is completely self-sufficient. They need nothing from the outside. No visitor ever enters the cloister. It must be observed only from afar. The sound of the sisters' voices, as soft as the song of the angels, heard from a distance as it drifts over the soft white blanket of snow that covers the birch forest. The sisters are, in fact, completely apart from the world. They have been since the winter of 1918, when the White Guards burned the Convent of Our Lady of Sorrows to the ground and executed all of its inhabitants for aiding a local company of Red Guards. Yet from the road, one can hear and see them still as they go about their daily chores. One can listen with delight to their heavenly voices as they chant their daily offices. They are truly heavenly. If you venture too close, wander off the road, and climb the gentle sloping hill to the convent for a closer look, or perhaps a listening place, you come face to face with the grim reality of the present. The charred, smoke-stained ruins and the somber stone-covered hill with its graves that mark the final resting place of a long dead order. And let me clear my throat again. This next one is called Music of the Night. If Russia has a national musical instrument, it is the accordion or gamashka. Almost every home has one, and almost everyone can play at least one tune on it, especially the older generation, those born before or during the Great Patriotic War. It is a lovely instrument that produces beautiful music. Like the people who play them, they vary in size and shape and range from elaborate hand-enameled antiques to modern state-of-the-art pieces. They are everywhere. Pedestrians stop on the street and listen as some pensioner or invalid sits on the corner and plays. People strolling in the park are delighted by the sound of some lilting Russian folk song or sad Soviet-era ballad. In subway stations, commuters listen as someone plays while they wait for their train, or as a military pensioner sits in the lobby and plays a stirring march to the crowd. On weekends, when the Russian soul is driven to the country like lemmings making for the sea, every car, every commuter train contains at least one accordion player. The artists range in age from 9 and younger to 90 and older. Most of the time, the music is highly appreciated, and the talent of these sidewalk musicians is greatly admired. Most of the time, the simple beauty of the spontaneous concerts is a welcome addition to the day. 3 o'clock in the morning is not one of those times. to be awakened from a sound sleep at some ungodly cow milking hour by the sound of someone playing Katyusha or Moscow My Own on his stomach Steinway is not a treat. It is an obvious, obnoxious nuisance. Dogs bark, babies cry, and cats hiss. It is not a pleasant experience. Fortunately, it does not happen often. Dmitry Rakin and his wife, Natasha, live in a small one-room flat on the third floor of a Khrushchev building on Kamagursky Perelik, Peruelik, in downtown Moscow. It is one of the prefabricated tenements former Premier Nikita Khrushchev had erected for returning servicemen and their families in the mid-1950s, known for poor heating, bad plumbing, and extremely poor acoustics. You can literally hear a pin drop from three floors away. Rakin and his wife had not lived in the flat long. They were newlyweds and had only moved in some 3 weeks before. Dmitry had inherited the flat from an uncle who had decided to move out of Moscow and back to his home village. Because of this, the Rakins did not know anyone in the building, at least not very well. The problem started almost as soon as the young couple moved in. Dmitry would wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning to the sound of someone below them playing the Gromashka. Now, Dima worked in the Moskvik automobile factory on a swing shift. Sleep was precious to him. He had to be at work at 5 o'clock in the morning, and the 3 o'clock concerts were timed just right to cheat him out of an hour's worth of sleep every night. Since he had to get up at 4 anyway, what was the use of going back to sleep? At first he ignored it, but after about 2 weeks it began to get on his nerves. The music didn't seem to bother Natasha, who slept right through it. This bothered Dima even more. Finally, his typical Russian stoicism gave way to darker emotions, and one morning in the summer of 1998, after 3 solid weeks of nocturnal misery, he got up to the sound of the music, yet another rendition of Moscow My Own, and decided to do something about it. This obnoxious disturbance just had to stop. He got up, dressed, and stepped out into the hall. He listened carefully until he got a definite idea as to where the music was coming from. Then he went down the stairs and into the second floor corridor. Now was the time, he thought. The building musician had just begun playing a fairly good rendition of Red Army March. Dima carefully listened at each door until he identified that of the culprit. Then he made his move. He stood as erect as possible, tried to look as distinguished as his 23 years would allow, and knocked on the door. After the fourth knock, the door opened, revealing an old gentleman, obviously in his 80s, with a broad smile on his face. "Come in, young man, do come in," the man beamed. "What brings you out so early in the morning? Come in and have a cup of tea." The old man was being so nice it was hard for Dima to be angry. Sleep, he knew, sometimes comes hard to the elderly, but he had to say something. "Grandfather," he began. All young people address older men and women as grandfather or grandmother. He cleared his throat and began again. "Grandfather, I hate to mention this, but I live upstairs. It's your accordion." "I suspected as much," the old man cut in. "Actually, I was hoping to annoy someone enough to get them to come and visit me. You see, I have so few guests." So that was it. Now Dima understood. His anger dissipated, replaced by pity. He stepped into the old man's flat and followed his host into the kitchen. On the table sat the most beautiful accordion he had ever seen. He admired it with an obvious look of awe on his face. It was black enamel with mother-of-pearl inlays. The keys were onyx and mother-of-pearl on silver mounts. He reached out to touch it as the old man poured the tea, then stopped short. It would not be proper without asking first. Without turning around, the old man muttered, "Go ahead, pick it up. Play it if you like. That's what it was made for." Dima couldn't play as much as he would have loved to. He traced the curves of the delicate inlays with his finger as his host served the tea. In no time at all, the old man was playing again, and both of them were singing. It was as if Dima had been transported to a different world, as if time itself had stopped. They sang the song of the workers, the songs of the last century. They sang of loves and wars lost and won. Finally, Dima excused himself and went back up to his flat. The old man, he had forgotten to get his name, waved goodbye to him and invited him back again. Dima, of course, eagerly agreed. He returned to his own flat, shaved, and had another cup of tea. It amazed him how little time he had actually spent with the old man. The clock said only 3:45. He had been gone only half an hour. At 4, he woke Natasha, said goodbye, and left for work. All day he thought about the lonely old man in the flat below his in his beautiful accordion. On his way home that afternoon, he stopped at the corner kiosk and bought a bottle of vodka and some cakes. As soon as he got to his building, he headed straight for the second floor flat and began knocking on the door. He intended to give his new friend a present. Hopefully the old man could teach him how to play the accordion. He had always wanted to learn. He knocked on and off for about 10 minutes. Finally, he decided the old man was out and turned to go home. He would come back later. As he turned away, he saw the building superintendent looking at him from down the hallway. He had a strange look on his face. Dima instantly thought that something must have happened to his new friend. "What's wrong?" he said. "Did something happen to Grandfather?" "Grandfather," the Nashelnik replied, "who are you talking about?" "You know," Dima answered, "the old man who lives here." He described the man in some detail. "Did something happen to him?" The superintendent eyed the bottle under Dima's arm. "Are you drunk?" "No, I'm not drunk," Dima responded indignantly. "I asked a simple question. Did something happen to the old man?" "You could say that," the superintendent answered. "That flat has been empty for years. The old man you just described was the last owner. He's been dead since, let me think, somewhere around 92, maybe 93. They found him dead in his living room." Let me clear my throat real quick. "He was playing his Gromashka and just fell forward, massive heart attack. He never knew what hit him." Dima went home and poured himself a stiff vodka, then chased it with another one, and another one. And okay, moving on to a different section of the book, a section that I've read part of already. I'm going to read this first one here. It's real short, a little more than one page. And then I'll play some more music and then start again. This one is called Little Kate. Mamontovka is not what you would call a big town. In fact, it's downright little bitty. It's one of those places that is so small, if you blink your eyes while passing through it, you'll miss it. Consequently, everyone knows everyone else. The main street is Kutsavosky Prospect, a narrow two-lane gravel track that goes right through the center of town, running from the old-fashioned shoe factory to the railway platform of about 5 kilometers, which is about 3 miles. Every other street in Mamontovka branches off from this main one thoroughfare. There are times late in the evening, just after the sun goes down, and the sky passes from twilight into blackness a full night, times when the street's empty and the night air crisp and clear. You can hear the unmistakable sounds of adults singing. You can hear tramping on the gravel of a large number of people walking along this quiet little street, marching in step. At times, if you look out the window, you can see a vague glow moving slowly down the road. The voices always sing the same song, Katusha, or Little Kate. Is one of those songs written during the war about a girl waiting for her soldier who will never return. It's sort of a Russian Lily Marlene. It happens almost every night. It happened almost every night for as long as anyone living in Mamatopka can remember. In July 1942, just over a year into the Second World War, our little town was the site of some pretty heavy fighting. At one point, when the Red Army was occupied elsewhere, the workers from the local shoe factory defended the town against the Germans for more than 2 weeks before any relief arrived. Armed with pitchforks, knives, gasoline bottles, and guns, they took off dead Germans in raw courage. More than half of them died, and they held Mamatopka until help arrived. As they marched to the front of that first blustery and bloody evening of the battle, more than 64 years ago now, right through the middle of town, they sang Little Kate, the song of a girl waiting patiently and hopefully for a lover who would never come home again. And let me play another one, and I'll be right back. Thank you. Okay, this next one is called Music in the Mist. And if you'll recall, I had mentioned that I had a friend who was from Texas that lived in Russia. And obviously, and of course I mentioned he was an author. And this is obviously his book. So anyway, let me get started. It says, not too far from where I live is the Uka River. Actually, it's less than half a mile away. The Uka isn't, properly speaking, a river in Texas, where I was born. They would call it a creek. It is about 50 feet wide and not more than 4 feet deep. It's easy to wade across, and now, 55 years after the end of the war, its waters run cool, clear, and clean, a home for small fish and a summer playground for the local children. It was not always so. In the spring and summer of 1943, the now peaceful little Uka ran red with the blood of the dead and dying. Cutting directly across the main Moscow to Yaroslavl highway, its single wooden two-lane bridge and its dozen or so easily forded places were much desired real estate between the opposing forces of the Red Army and Hitler's crack Waffen SS divisions. The little river changed hands an average of five times every month for more than a year, as the front lines drifted back and forth over a two-mile-wide strip of hotly contested ground. During some of the heaviest fighting in the area, the Germans had a field hospital set up on the riverbank. From all descriptions, it was like a scene from Dante's Inferno, with overworked doctors working around the clock to save the lives of German and Russian alike. Long-term local residents even now grimace as they describe the rancid, putrid stench that permeated the air, the smell of gangrene mixed with cordite, and the rotting piles of amputated limbs that steadily grew outside the makeshift surgery tents. They also tell of how the wounded, when they were once again lucid, hobbled around the hospital grounds on their crutches or lay on the riverbank, waiting for the chance to be taken away from the front. How at night they would gather around the cooking fires and eat their meager rations and sing the songs of long ago to pass the idle hours. Now in the evening, just about dusk, if you listen hard enough, you can still hear the sounds of German music being played on a concertina or accordion coming from the area of the old field hospital and the sounds of men singing. If you listen hard enough, you can make out the words, and if you can speak a bit of German, no matter what your feelings toward the war might be, you will understand. Now you will feel a deep sympathy for the lonely, pain-racked men who sing of the watch on the Rhine. They have been called on to keep 3,000 miles from that great river on the banks of the bloody little Uka. You will weep for the lovely Lily Marlene and the dying soldier who will never see his girl again. Vor der Kaserne, vor dem großen Tor. I guess I said that right. That's all German. A sad song sung by the even sadder spirits. The local children often made a pilgrimage to the site of the old field hospital, trying to find the ghost they have all heard singing in the night, but so far none of them has ever seen any. However, the area does hold a notorious cold spot where dogs and cats and other animals will not go, and if you stay there long enough, you are overcome with an overpowering feeling of almost bottomless despair and depression, a boundless sadness and pain that seems to cling to you like a wet blanket and permeate your very bones. And this next one is called A Red Star Shines in the Morning. Mamontovka, Pushkino, Taratovska, and the other small towns and villages in northeastern Moskovsky Oblast or Moscow County are not exactly metropolitan areas. I don't think I read this one. Yeah, I believe I did. Yeah, I read that one. Definitely read that one. So we will skip that one. Next one is called Feldwebel Moritz. Okay, Feldwebel Moritz. This story is not my own. It has been told in several places, but I happen to know the man it happened to and heard the story directly from him. His summer house, the one in the story, is located near my own. I will relate the story as it was told to me with as little interpretation as possible. I will not mention full names, as Chris is a member of a respected profession and a bit sensitive about this. 2 years ago, Chris and his wife went to their country house in the wife's village, his wife's village near Smolensk. This area saw some of the heaviest fighting in the Second World War, and the landscape is still, some 60 years later, littered with the refuse of battle from both sides. Just momentarily lost my spot. Not a day passes but that someone wandering through the forest finds a wrestling hulk of an old tank or some old other vehicle, and everyone in the area has a collection of belt buckles, knives, bayonets, rusting old guns, and helmets. Several times a year, some farmer will dig up the remains of one of the thousands of unclaimed dead who lie in the area. This is what happened to Chris. All Russians are, at heart, farmers. We all have our dachas, or country houses, and we have our gardens. Chris was working in his, laying in a potato trench, when he found human remains. The body, of course, nothing but bones, but along with the bones he found a German belt buckle, canteen, two hand grenades, a pistol, and other items that had not rotted away with time. He also found the soldier's identification disc still hanging from a rusted steel chain around the skeleton's neck. It identified the man as Oberfeldwebel, Senior Sergeant Otto Moritz, gave his blood type O, and stated that he was a Protestant. Chris gathered the remains, took the bones and ID disc to the German embassy in Moscow, to the graves registration section, and the two old rusting grenades to the local police for disposal. He had hopes the German embassy could locate any living relatives Otto Moritz might have had, or at least let them know his body had been recovered. Now, Chris at that time was a drinking man. That night after returning from Moscow, he sat at his kitchen table with a bottle of cognac in a glass, thinking over what he had found. When he looked up, a tall, heavy-set man sat across the table from him. The man had sandy red hair, clear blue eyes, and a big smile on his face. Chris didn't think anything about it. Neighbors drop by all the time here in Russia. His only real thought was, if he wants a drink, he'll have to buy the next bottle for himself. Chris was having troubles with his wife at the time. She had also taken to drinking heavily, and relationship-wise, the two of them were definitely on the way out. He was depressed, and finding a body on his property had depressed him even more. He was crying silently as he drank. Let me clear my throat. He looked up at his guest and offered him the bottle and a glass. The man was dressed in a gray-green colored jacket, buttoned all the way to the collar, sported about a week's growth of beard, and had the smell of stale sweat and leather about him. He waved away the bottle, but did take one of Chris's cigars, which were lying on the table. He then leaned over the table toward Chris and said, in broken accented English that had a musical lilt to it, "I am here to help you, but you realize, of course, you must be helping of yourself. You must leave alone to drink. Be away with it. Do not be sitting here crying like the woman. Be a man. Are you not the Mensch?" Sorry for the bad-sounding German accent. Chris was sounding somewhat miffed that a stranger would talk to him like this, but didn't say anything. He looked up and was about to reply and discovered the visitor was gone. He didn't think any more about it until the next day. It was strange, but no stranger than a lot of things he had seen in Russia. He figured the man had just come, put his 2 cents in, and gone home. The next day, he was back in his garden, working away on his potato trench. when he looked up to see a man standing at the end of his plot, about 20 feet from where he was working. The man wore the uniform of a German Panzer Grenadier, a steel helmet, a camouflage tunic, gray trousers, and high-topped boots with grenades tucked into the boot tops. He had on full field gear and was carrying a machine pistol. The collar tabs of his smock bore the twin lightning bolts of the Waffen-SS. As Chris looked closer, he recognized the man's face. It was the same man who had visited him the night before. Oberfeldwebel Otto Moritz smiled broadly at Chris, saluted, then slowly began to fade as he turned and walked away. Chris never saw him again. As a postlude, I will say that Chris did, in fact, stop drinking and get into AA, as did his wife. They are now living a happy, quiet life, divided between their home in Moscow and their Dacha in Smolensk. The summer after his visitation, Chris put a small stone in the corner of his garden. It reads, Otto Moritz, Oberfeldwebel, 12th Waffen SS, Panzer Grenadiers, 1898 to 1943. Ich hatte einen Kameraden. I had a friend. And let's see how long this next one is. It's very short. I'll read it and then play a song, call it a show. It's called Stand Until Relieved. For 54 years, the residents of Pushkino, the little town just down the railroad line from mine, who were driving at night, would report sighting armed men, three or four soldiers and an officer, standing around the Uka River Bridge on the western outskirts of town. No one really paid any attention, since the local kasarma, or barracks, is located not too far away. It wasn't unusual to see soldiers. The indifference changed slightly in the early 1960s when the Russian Army acquired new uniforms. What made this significant was that the uniforms worn by the soldiers at the bridge remained the same. People then began to take notice. The reports continued to come in. About three or four times a year, Major Anatoly Shukin of the regional police office got used to getting calls in the middle of the night about the soldiers at the bridge. He collected quite a pile of them in his 15-year-long stint as senior officer. Typically, he would send a car out to investigate. The patrol would find nothing and return to the office. Chalk up another one to much vodka and not enough sleep. All along, he heard his patrolmen talking about exactly what they did see. It seemed most of the ones sent out actually did see soldiers at the bridge, just as described. Three or four soldiers and an officer dressed in old-fashioned uniforms and carrying out-of-date weapons. When the car got closer, the men would simply vanish. Let me clear my throat. Shukin now suspected his officers were drinking. Not uncommon. Not good, but not uncommon. Then one night, he responded to the call himself. He saw the same thing. He knew he wasn't drunk. On it went. Then in the summer of 1997, someone was doing research at the Kasarma and found something interesting. It seemed that during the war, in the spring of 1943, just after the Red Army had retaken the area from the Germans, a detail of four soldiers from the barracks, led by a young lieutenant named Daniel Linko, were ordered to go out and secure the bridge over the Uka and to stand there and hold their ground until they were relieved. Relief never came, but the Germans did. The Wehrmacht counterattacked and retook the area, at least temporarily. Daniel Linko and his men were never seen again. Armed with this information, a healthy curiosity, a mine detector from the Kasarma, and a picnic lunch packed by his wife, Major Shukin, went out to the Uka Bridge one Saturday afternoon and had a look around. After about 2 hours of sleep of sweeping, he found the body of one soldier, and not too long after the other three, there was quite an uproar. All of the soldiers had come from the Pushchino region, and two of them had living relatives. The Kasarma furnished a squad to fire a final salute and a burial detail, and the local newspapers all showed up when the four loyal soldiers were finally buried in their Pushchino city cemetery. Unfortunately, this did not end their sightings. Finally, in May of 1999, Shukin, who was about to retire, had an idea. He was right. He knew how to lay the spirits to rest. He drove out to the Kasarma and had a talk with the commandant, Colonel Vitaly Maslov. Together, they and four soldiers, who were more or less grabbed at random, loaded into two used transport vehicles similar to an American Jeep and drove out to the bridge. When they got there, Maslov brought his men to attention and formally relieved Lieutenant Danielenko and his squad of their duties. He and Shukin then climbed back aboard their vehicle and headed back to Pushchino, leaving the guard detachment on duty until the next morning. The guard was never posted again. The sightings have stopped. And I'll play a song to go out with. All right, where was I at? Here it is.